All right, so today we are going to start talking about the ninth commandment of the moral law, which is you shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. So we're going to be talking today by way of introduction about truth and what it means to be truthful and why this is such an important thing. A number of years ago, I worked in a vet clinic with a girl named Carly. She was a high school student, a very cute girl, charming, talented. She went to a local private school, one of the better private schools in the area, so she had a lot going for her. As I got to know her better and better, I discovered something rather disturbing about this girl. However, it came to be, she had reached this point in the life in her life where she didn't really see any reason to be honest if it didn't benefit her personally. In other words, Carly did not love truth for its own sake, but only as a means of getting something else that she wanted. So she would tell the truth if she saw that it benefited her personally. But for the same reason, she would also lie. She didn't mind resorting to falsehood if she saw that that's what benefited her personally. So you couldn't trust her. You couldn't trust her to tell you the truth. And the more I realized this about this girl, the more I disliked her. Even though she was cute and charming and had a lot of potential, a lack of honesty in a person, a soul that has no love for truth for its own sake, is really a deplorable defect in character. As human beings, we're made in the image of God. We say that above all else, that means that in the beginning we were made in knowledge and righteousness and holiness, and so it is our proper nature to be lovers of truth, as God is a lover of truth. But since the fall, none of us love the truth as we ought to, and so it is, as King David says in Psalm 116, that all men are liars. We all have this deplorable defect in our character. So we're going to lament that today and see some of the reasons why this is such a sad fact of our spiritual lives. First, a few definitions. What do we mean by truth? Sometimes you hear people pretending to be philosophers who speak of anything that is as truth. This blackboard is truth, and that tree is truth, and anything that is truth. Well, that's actually just confusing, meaningful terms. We already have a term for what is, and that's what's real. The blackboard is real. The tree is real. So that's the word we use for what is. Truth is then the communication of what really is. And so the point that I'm making here is truth, and as we're going to be talking about it, is about communication, and that means that that's what the ninth commandment is about. This is a moral commandment that speaks to moral issues regarding our communication with one another. Now, there are two senses in which we speak of truth. In general, in order to have truth, we need both accuracy and honesty in any communication. So in my communication to you, if I lack accuracy, if my own ideas about things are somehow different from the way they really are, then we have not truth, but an error or a mistake, which is an innocent falsehood. But if we lack honesty, if I actually know the truth, I know what is really, but I decide that I'm I don't want to share that with you. I want to deceive you and make you think something is which is not. Then we have a lie or a deception, and that is a malicious or a guilty falsehood. So in ethics, which is what we're talking about now, when we talk about truth, we're talking about honesty in communication, even when the accuracy sometimes is lacking. So Robert Dabney defines it like this. He says, truth is using signs, means words, gestures, the signs of communication. Truth is the using of signs by which we express or assert anything conformably to our belief of the real estate of the things spoken of. So when I'm being truthful with you, I'm telling you how things really are as I understand them. My understanding could be defective. I might not understand things as clearly as I ought to, and so there might be some error in my communication. But at least on my part, I'm trying my best to tell you how things really are as I understand them. That's what we mean by truth or being truthful. And so it's in this sense that our duty under the ninth commandment of the moral law is to preserve and promote truth between man and man. The ninth commandment doesn't condemn making mistakes, making honest errors in terms of our communication regarding reality. It's just the deceptive aspect of it, the lack of honesty. All right, so with those kind of preliminary definitions aside, I want to spend the rest of the time talking about truth and truthfulness and why it is important. And here I'm gonna lean real heavily upon the things written in the 19th century by Robert Dabney on this particular subject. Just to remind you, Robert Dabney was a Southern Presbyterian in the 19th century during the time of the Civil War. He spent most of his career at Union Seminary in Virginia. He was the chaplain in Stonewall Jackson's army. That's one of his significant facts of his resume. And he's probably best known for his defense of slavery at the time of the Civil War and all the debates that were going on between the North and the South in those times. And for that reason, a lot of people don't like Robert Dabney, don't want to cite him or in any way be associated with him. But that's unfortunate. That was one issue. He spoke to many things, and so I find that there's a great bit of benefit to be derived from studying Dabney. He's particularly insightful concerning ethics or the law. That's why I find them to be most helpful. I'm basically just going to walk you through the highlights of Dr. Dabney's teaching on the Ninth Commandment and the subject of truth and truthfulness, because I have always found it to be really profound and also helpful as well. I thought perhaps I couldn't do better than just to start with his own words. So, the first point that that Dabney makes in his systematic theology on the Ninth Commandment is that only truth is of practical use to man in his life. Only truth is of practical use to man in his life. So this is what he says. He says, all the practical concerns of man's life are with the real state of things. Fictitious informations are to us naught or worse than naught. They may fatally betray us into mistake. They cannot be the grounds of any beneficial or successful action. On the real state of the markets depends the merchant's profits. On the real power of the medicine depends the physician's success and the sick man's restoration. On the real nature of vegetable loss depends the reward of the farmer's toil. And every conceivable concern of man, it is truth, the communication which is in accordance with reality, that is useful. Okay? You understand his point? So in other words, in order to be able to make good decisions in my life, in order to make decisions that will bring about the result that I am am seeking or the goal that I'm trying to accomplish. I need to know the truth about things. I need to know how things really are. And so the knowledge, the communication of truth, of the reality of things to me, is useful. If I have that, then I can do things with it. I can make sound decisions and accomplish things on the basis of that knowledge. Whereas a falsehood, something which is not true, something that just somebody says, but which does not accurately represent reality, is of no use to me. Right? I can't do anything with that. It's just a fantasy. It's make believe. There's no correspondence to reality. You can't build anything on it. You can't launch from that point onto another point at all. And particularly if you tell me something that's false and lead me to believe that it's true when it's not, then potentially you could cause me to make a serious error, right? Thinking that something is true, that it is real when it is not, then I can fall into all sorts of errors that way. So he starts here with the usefulness of truth precisely because it corresponds with reality. That's something that I can do something with, make wise decisions that will be a benefit of me and those that I love. That's his point. So as we think about, you know, why is truth and telling the truth so important? This is where we begin. Because it's important to us as human beings in the practical decisions of our lives. He goes on and says then that man naturally desires truth. So he's trying to prove that truth is important to us by observing that we have a natural desire for truth. This is the way he says it. He says, accordingly, our Maker, that is God, has endued us with a mental appetite of which truth is the natural food. The statement on which we cannot rely gives us no pleasure. True, another faculty than the understanding, the fancy, finds its appropriate pleasure in fiction. But here also a tribute is paid to the truth. For in order that the fictitious may give any pleasure to the fancy, even it must be truth-like. I don't know how you feel about that, but when I read a story and it's unrealistic, even if I know it's fiction, I think it's not very good fiction, right? So that's just the point he's making there. But the main point he's making is that we, our minds, crave truth and find pleasure in it in the same way that our bodies crave food and take pleasure in it. And so why do our bodies crave food and take pleasure in it? Well, it's because our bodies need food. They need it for their health. And in the same way, the reason that our minds crave truth and find pleasure in it is because we need it for our health with respect to our thinking about things and making practical decisions. So it's sort of a philosophical argument based upon what we know about human nature. But I think that there is certainly something to it. We'd also point out here that in the same way that we find food pleasant and desirable, we find poison or rotten food deplorable. It makes us unhealthy. In the same way, that's what you get with a lie. You get a poisoned truth, and you can have no pleasure in it. It brings a lack of health to the mind, and is harmful to you in many ways in your life. Now, here's an important point. Thirdly, he says, for truth to be useful to man, he must be confident that it is truth. Okay? So let's say that you tell me something that is true. Right? So based on what we said so far, now I have something useful. But what if I know you to be a dishonest human being? And I'm never sure if what you're telling me is the truth or not. In this case, the reality is I have the truth, but I have a hard time doing anything with it, building anything upon it, because of the what I know about your character, I never can be sure that it actually is the truth. It might actually be a falsehood, in which case it would be a bad thing for me to attempt to do anything with it or build anything of any substance upon it. So I not only need truth, but I need to know that the person who has shared the truth with me is truthful, if it is truly to be useful to me. And if that's not there, then even truth itself ceases to be useful to me. So he says, now honesty is the observance of truth in our communications. Its importance appears from the fact that almost all man knows is derived from communication. The whole value of the statements we receive is in their truth. If they're false, they're not, or worse than not. The usefulness of communicated knowledge to us depends, therefore, wholly on our confidence in its truth. So, you hear there the point we're making. Almost everything that we know in life is based upon communication. It's really only a small percentage of what we know and what we deal with from day to day that we derived wholly on the basis of our own experience. Most of the things that we know, we've learned from reading or listening to other people and the things that they have told us. But all that knowledge is ultimately dependent upon being able to trust the people who are talking to you. And if you lose that, then you're left with a very, very small percentage of what we actually could and would like to know. The only thing we can trust is our own experience, and we're sort of shut off from all the other help that we ought to receive from other people's experience. So the next point is that lies destroy man's confidence in truth and thus its usefulness to him. Is that distracting you guys? They're moving on. Okay. So the next point is that lies destroy man's confidence in truth and thus its usefulness to him. So that's the point I've made. He says every lie. Okay, so this is where my own personal responsibility comes in. Every lie helps to destroy that confidence. Just so far as we perceive lies prevail, so far the value of communicated knowledge to us is destroyed. Should we reach that state when no trust could be put in the veracity or honesty of any fellow man, all such knowledge would, to us, virtually cease to exist. Okay? So, the more lies that people tell in a society, whether it's within a marriage or in a family or in society at large, the more people are lying and being lied to, the more our confidence in communication deteriorates, right? We have this unfortunate experience of realizing that when somebody tells us something, they might be trying to deceive us. And it gets harder and harder to believe anything that anybody tells us, the more people we find are actually liars and lying to us. And when we ourselves begin to lie to other people about things that we know are true, then that even further deteriorates our confidence. Because if we know that we will lie, we can only assume that everybody else around us would lie as well. So he goes on, this is a long quote, to make the point that lies then undermine the shared knowledge that is the basis of civilization. Okay, so he's going to carry this point a long way. But when we tell lies, what we're actually destroying, what we're actually undermining, is the basis, the foundation of human civilization. He says, but to what state would this reduce us? The wise teach the ignorant. The skill of each generation does not die with it, but is communicated to the next. Knowledge is handed down until our generation finds itself endowed with accumulated experience of all previous ones. It is this which makes our civilization. But if all reliance upon communicated knowledge is destroyed, we are reduced to a state of savage ignorance. We should know nothing but what we had ourselves seen and experienced, because we could trust nothing else.
Education would be impossible, for how can knowledge be communicated when truth is banished? The advance which each individual made in such a condition would wholly die with him. His son must begin life as he did, an ignorant savage, and run the same contracted round of puny, misdirected progress, and in his turn die, carrying all his knowledge to the grave with him. The latest generation would live in the same savage ignorance with the earliest. Religion would be as impossible as education, and all its blessings and consolations equally unknown, for religion cannot exist without trust. Each one of you would be an insulated, helpless wretch. And he makes this final comment. He who deals in falsehood does what in him lies to bring his race to this degraded and miserable state. If all men should be false like him, and in all their communications, this state would actually be reached. Okay? So, certainly I am not responsible for what everybody else says. But I am responsible for what I say. And what Dabney is doing here is he's taking the individual's responsibility. And he's saying, all right, and so let's say that you are a liar. Okay, you don't love truth for its own sake. You don't think that's particularly important for you to be honest if it doesn't serve your purposes. So you deal in lies. You tell the truth when it works for you, but when it doesn't, then you tell whatever falsehood it takes to deceive somebody to get what it is you want. Every time that you do this, in particular, every time it's found out that you have lied, you undermine this confidence that we have in what other people say to us. And if everybody did what you're doing, then we would be in a society where nobody could trust what anybody else said. We would not be able to share knowledge from generation to generation or from neighbor to neighbor. And what would eventually happen is that our civilization would crumble, right? We would become, in a sense, isolated. Every individual would be isolated because the only thing that he could know and build his life on was what he could know on the basis of his own experience. Because all the possibility for shared knowledge is destroyed by the lies. Does it make sense? You understand his point? He goes on and says, lies make it impossible for men to trust one another and thus to cooperate with one another. Okay, so now we're not just talking about the truth upon which I as an individual might do something or build something. But there's also these things that we accomplish as human beings and civilization where we're working together. Things that we can accomplish working together that we cannot accomplish if we're working alone. And here again, this truthfulness, the ability to share knowledge and to know that what I've been told is sound, accords with reality, is absolutely critical. He says, it may be shown in another light that the liar is the enemy of God and man by considering the effect of his vice on our mutual confidence. The intercourse of human business is but a countless series of implied engagements. Unless we can trust the fidelity or the faithfulness of those whom we must employ, cooperation is at an end. If you cannot trust the postman who contracts to carry your letters, the conductor who guides the vehicle in which you ride, the pilot who steers your ship, the agent who transacts your business, the cook who engages to dress your food, you can neither write nor ride, nor sail nor eat, nor conduct any trade. Government would be at an end, because the ruler could not trust his agents and officers, and his power would be limited to his own presence. In short, if confidence is destroyed, then all the bands which unite man with his fellows are loosed. Each man must struggle on unaided by his fellows, as though he were the sole forlorn remnant of a perishing race. So, we try to make up for this this problem of deception with contracts and things, right? Or in the old world, they would do it by vows, sworn in the name of God, and those sorts of things. You know, why do we make contracts? Why do we sign contracts? It's because we're entering into a cooperation in which I really need to be able to trust that you're going to do what you said you're going to do. That you're not telling me a lie, or that you're not going to go back on your word later on down the road. I'm about to invest something. I'm about to put something at risk on the basis of your word, and I need to know that it's true. And so we have contracts, and you have to sign the contracts, and we have laws to punish you if you're perhaps engaged in fraud. But we all know that this will only carry us so far, that there's a point in which the corruption, the deception, can reach an extent where you can't even trust in the contracts, or you can't even trust in the government to enforce the laws. And this is what you find in civilizations which we know are in a worse state than which we are. I perhaps have mentioned before, in when I worked in the vet clinic in Lawrenceville, that we had some clients who were from Eastern Europe, from Romania and those countries over there. And those people would come in the door, and they would immediately begin to assume that you were lying to them. Immediately. I mean, I didn't do anything to suggest to these people that what I was telling them was anything less than the absolute truth. But it was an assumption of their world. If somebody else is talking to me in a matter of business, then they are lying to me. Well, why would they think that? Because that's the way it is over there. That's the way they themselves do business. That's the way everybody else around them does business. And it is crippling their society. It's making it impossible for them to get any farther than they already are now. It just reduces all possible business and human competition, cooperation to this sort of petty market situation where everybody just brings their goods to the street and we're all in there haggling with each other to try to get the best deal that we can by being the best liar that we can be. You just can't get very far as a civilization when that's the way things are. And that's the way things can become here, too, if the moral decline continues. As it gets harder and harder and harder to trust people, because more and more people are like Carly and just don't see any reason why they should tell the truth if it doesn't benefit them, we're in big trouble as a society. It's a huge problem, which would affect us in ways that it is scary to think about. He adds this last point: lies destroy trust between persons and so destroy their relationships. So now we're not only talking about business, but we're talking about friendships. We're talking about marriages and families, relationship between parents and their children. Just briefly, he says, confidence is as essential also to the social affections which shed happiness on the heart as to the utilities of our outer life. It is the basis of friendship and love. To mistrust is to despise. To trust, to be trusted with unshaken faith, is the charm of domestic love. A man and his wife just cannot have a good, loving relationship if they can't trust each other, if they've learned that they cannot trust each other. A father and his son cannot have a good relationship if the son has learned that he can't trust the word of his father, or the father has learned that he can't trust the word of his son, so forth and so on. So that cuts even deeper in a way that's even more painful. We consider the implications of honesty and dishonesty. All right, so now he really drives this point home. You know, how big a deal is this for me to tell a lie? Right? Why should I care? Why should I, seeing that I could gain some little advantage by telling a lie instead of telling the truth, what should stop me? Right? What should make me pause before I take that step? He says, the loss of truth reduces men to the state of savagery. And here again, I think Dabney's insights into the state of savagery are incredible. He says, were there no truth then, every fellow man would be your enemy. You would be insulated from your kind. Every social affection would take its flight from the earth. Man would be reduced to a solitary, miserable savage, whose hand would be against every man and every man's hand against him. This is what was said of Cain. Indeed, the conditions of savage society are sufficient illustrations of my conclusions. For when you examine it, the causes of its barbarism, when you detect why savages are, compared with civilized men, few, poor, wretched, insecure, and unfurnished with all the blessings which ameliorate life, you perceive that it is because falsehood and unrighteousness have made trust, mutual aid, and instruction almost impossible among them. They remain such only because they cannot trust each other. Savagery is simply sin, and most notably, the sin of lying. That's fascinating, right? Why do some people groups in the earth live in a state of savagery? And why is it they're unable to get out of that state of savagery? They say it's ignorance. If you look into those societies, it's a lot more than ignorance. It's sin. These are societies in which lying is the standard, right? This is something that the elders and we had deacons that we experienced with the people living in poverty around here, is that these people lie constantly. It's their world. You can't trust anything that they say to you, and they don't trust anything that you say to them, because that's the way it's always been in their life. Right? And so it makes it so it's impossible for them to be of any use to anybody else, or to gain any use from what anybody else would give to them. And so that's why they're kind of just always going around sort of scheming, barely trying to get a little bit ahead as they move from day to day in this miserable world in which they can't trust anybody in their lives. So I think what Debbie's saying here is precisely right, which is a scary thing, but he's not done. His next point is that hell is a world of liars. Okay, so let's take this to its ultimate extreme. Where do we find ourselves? We find ourselves in hell. The Bible describes everything associated with hell as being a place where falsehood reigns. He says there is a world just such as the liar would make this one, where falsehood reigns and where confidence is unknown. There in its fiery lake, all liars have their part. The ruler of this world, that is the devil, is he who was a liar from the beginning and the father of it. There to deceive and to be deceived is the universal rule, and therefore mistrust sits brooding over every heart and scowls in every look. Each one beholds in every other an object of fear and scorn, and feels an equal scorn for himself because he knows himself as false as they. In the midst of myriads, each suffering heart is alone, for it finds no other breast on which it can repose. Hostility and solitude separate each wretch from his fellows, and the only society is the reciprocations of reproaches and injuries. Hell is but the complete and universal reign of falsehood, and the tendency of every lie is to reduce this world to it. So you think about people in hell and their misery, you think about them being isolated, but it's not physical walls that isolate people in hell. It is the universal state of mistrust in large part. Again, another profound insight. You think about savagery and what that's about. You can see that they're on that road. Dabney stops here. Dabney always has a concern for children and education, particularly among Christians. So he makes his point concerning children. He said, children should be taught that truth is sacred. And that's just a simple statement. But, how should you, when you teach your children about truth and telling the truth, how should you talk about that with them as if it's sacred, he's saying. He says, a sacred regard for truth should be inculcated on the young, especially. They should be taught to regard lying as the inlet of all vice and corruption. So when my children do something wrong and I go to address it and correct them, we have a code orange situation here. In their response to me, if I get caught in a lie, then we've gone from a code orange to a code red situation. The seriousness of what's going on has just been taken to a whole nother level when my children endeavor to deceive me by telling a falsehood. We take it very, very seriously. And so we should, both positively and negatively, that's how we have to deal with this in our world, especially when your children are going to be surrounded with people like Carly. They need to know positively that the truth is something important, something beautiful, something to love in and of itself, and that to tell a lie then is to offend against something quite sacred. The next point is that the next three points then are Dabney kind of goes from practical teaching to more lofty philosophical teaching, and feel him sort of leaving us, which he does sometimes. He's quite the philosopher, and so a lot of times when I'm reading him, I'm with him, and then I'm no longer with him anymore because he's just gone over my head. But he's trying to make a really important point here, and so it's an opportunity for us to really gain something if we will engage with him and try to understand what he's saying. Basically what he's saying here is that when it comes to the actual moral obligation, our moral obligation to be truthful and to tell the truth, the ground of that moral obligation is not actually these practical concerns. We just point that out to show just how important truth really is to us. But there's something more basic that we need to get at to understand why it is that I am morally obligated to tell the truth just for truth's sake. And this is what he says. He says, the moral obligation to tell the truth is grounded in the nature of man. Okay? And this is how I was explaining this before I read his words. Why is it that I am morally obligated to see to it that my neighbor has food? Because that's one of the things that we've said so far under the sixth commandment, right? If I see that my neighbor is starving for a lack of food, then I should feel myself morally obligated to try to feed him, to try to provide that food. Well, it has to do with human nature. It's the recognition that food is very important to him. It's necessary for his health and life to have food. And so when I see that he lacks it, then I have a moral obligation to try to provide what he needs. In the same way, so it's based on the nature of man. If that wasn't true about the relationship between man and food, then the moral obligation wouldn't be there. I'm not morally obligated to provide for fashion for my neighbor if I see that he lacks it. Because it's not essential to his well-being, right? It's just sort of a superficial thing. But not so with food. It's very important to him. So in the same way, if you understand the nature of man and how important truth is to man's soul, to the health of his soul and to his life, then you see that if he lacks it and then you have it, then you're obligated to give it to him if you can. It's that kind of argument. So this is what he says. He says, in thus illustrating the usefulness and importance of the practice of honesty, I do not intend to rest its obligation on that ground. These facts are merely subordinate to the argument. They illustrate, but do not constitute the obligation. The moral obligation to be honest is grounded in the fact that truth is natural to man's soul. As the eye craves light, so the mind loves the truth. It's the natural instinct of the mind, undebauched by a sinful experience, to credit what is told it by any rational fellow creature. And it requires the bitter experience of deceptions often repeated to curb this tendency. So we are inclined to want to believe that what other people tell us is true, because we love the truth and because we need the truth. And so that tendency to want to believe people, to want to be able to take them at his word, is an indication of how much our nature actually needs the truth. He goes on and says, while we are limited to the sphere of philosophy and natural theology, then, which means putting aside our Bibles for the second and just arguing this as a matter of philosophy, he says, we find the obligation to truth in these fundamental facts, which reveal the will of the Creator as it is impressed in the constitution of the soul. Again, that the reason that we love truth, the reason that we desire it, the reason why we're inclined to believe what people tell us, is because this is the will of God for us. Because He has made our nature thus, that we should be lovers of the truth and dependent upon it. He says, to those, therefore, who would ask, why am I bound to speak the truth? I would briefly answer, because it is the law of our nature. It's the fundamental datum of conscience, a command of God impressed upon the moral structure of the soul. And it follows, hence, the obligation is universal. So this can be demonstrated from philosophy and natural theology. And it's true not only of Christians, but of everybody. That's basically what the last point is. But then he goes on and says, furthermore, he's getting still deeper, the moral obligation to tell the truth is grounded in the nature of God. Okay, so now he brings in the Bible. He says, when we pass from philosophy to revelation, we find a still broader and deeper foundation for the obligation to truth in that nature of the God who cannot lie and who is the God of truth. And he's quoting there the scriptures. His precepts are sure and sufficient rule of our duty. He's told us that every liar is an abomination in his sight and has required us to speak truth to one another. So God's moral commandments are based on God's own moral nature. Why are we obligated to speak the truth to one another? Because God loves the truth. Okay. That's the ultimate reason. Why do we love the truth? Why is it our nature to be lovers of truth? Because we're made in the image of God. And God loves the truth. And that really, when we come to the question of the moral obligation to speak the truth, that's when we've come to the end of the road. That's when we've come to the ultimate grounds. We can no more get away from this than we can get away from God. So his final point is this, that the righteous man is an honest man who loves truth for its own sake. The righteous man is an honest man who loves truth for its own sake. Not for what you can get out of it, but just because it is the truth. And so here, I didn't include all these quotes, but Dabney shows from Scripture that in many places, righteousness and truth are used almost synonymously. To righteousness is truth, and truth is righteousness, at least when we consider the moral aspect of honesty. So this is his concluding thought. He says, every right habit of action implies a right disposition of will. This general law should be enough to convince us of another great fact, which is too often overlooked in ethical discussions of this duty, that there is a virtue of truthfulness back of or behind the practice of honesty and the source of it which we're bound to possess. This is the love of truth for its own sake. So this is that idea of the spirituality of the law, right? If I tell the truth, but only because I know that if I don't, you're going to whack me in the back of the head, then that doesn't make me a good person, right? That's not a sign that my heart is right. So if I hope to be morally upright, for the image of God to be restored to me in these things, I not only need to tell the truth, but I need to tell the truth as somebody who loves the truth, somebody who tells the truth for its own sake, because I love that as God loves it. And so, as we go on next week to talk about our duties under the ninth commandment of the moral law, I just provide this introduction to add a necessary degree of weight to this particular subject with respect to our communications. Because I think one of the things that we are seeing in our society right now is a deterioration of honesty in communication from the top down. One of the things that we are seeing, and I think it is a change, as I understand what's gone before us, where for politicians on every possible side no longer feel that it is their obligation as leaders to tell the truth for truth's sake. They have political objectives, which they think are important, and they think that are important for people and the happiness of society. And those things are the most important things in their minds. And if they have to tell a lie, if they have to tell a lie to other politicians, if they have to tell a lie to the American people, if they have to tell a lie to the press in order to achieve their political objectives, then they think that that's okay. So the political objectives are first. Truth is only secondary here and can be compromised for the political objectives. And if you think about what Dabney is saying here, whatever it is that they think that they're achieving to their political objectives, what they're compromising by telling lies to achieve it is far more destructive to this country than any sort of political victory that they might achieve. These are our leaders. This is the example that's being set for us. And it filters all the way down into the most intimate relationships of our lives. And it's a great concern to us. And so this is a call for us as Christians to be different in this respect. This is one way when we can certainly be a light in the midst of darkness. So let's pray.